Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 126 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. I don't know about you, but after more than a year and a half minimizing contact with people, even an introvert like me is starting to miss parties. The company, the food, the music, the laughter and storytelling, there's nothing like a good party to build relationships and unwind. So this week, I invited Peter Konieczny from medievalist.net to join me to take a walk back through the centuries to the medieval world of parties. Whether you're crashing a celebration in early medieval Baghdad, or you're trying to impress your dining partner in late medieval England, we've got you covered. So without further ado, let's start the party. Welcome back, Peter, to talk about parties in the Middle Ages.
I know. If we're not having parties now, let's talk about parties in the past.
Yeah, because I think they had a lot of good parties in the past. Okay, so when it comes to party time in the Middle Ages, people celebrated all sorts of stuff, from like big milestones like marriages and things like that, or they just had a party for the sake of having a party, right?
Oh, yeah. I think any excuse to like get everyone to eat. You know, like if you host a party, it's a good way to get a little fame and, you know, respect around the community and among your peers. So, yeah, you know, like you want to host. And then if you're a guest, you just want to have a nice meal.
Yeah, why not? You want to show up, you want to eat. It is a good way to network, even in the Middle Ages, especially if you're trying to move up. If we're thinking of people kind of in the quote unquote middle class, where they're tradespeople and they want to get into a guild or something like that, it's good to get to know the community. And a good way to do that is to throw a party.
Well, man, you get a lot of fun. But it's mostly about the eating. When you kind of look at these medieval texts, it's not a party unless you have good food.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the Good Man of Paris's book, and he mentions how much food goes into a party, and it's ridiculous how much food people were eating. And as someone who doesn't really like cooking, it makes me always think about the effort that would go into cooking for these parties.
Oh, yeah. We noticed like those kind of cookbooks are very elaborate meals, right? Like how to stuff your swan with fish, you know, that kind of
after it's dead.
Is that kind of presentation, but they simply want to like, hey, let's make this as unusual and interesting as possible. And like, I guess the idea is to get people to talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So you'd have like super elaborate meals where there are many, many courses, and in between there's entertainment or subtleties, as they're called, which are usually desserts. They're usually technically edible, but sometimes they're castles of love. Sometimes they're swans with the feathers put back on. It's really amazing stuff. So let's get to the food in a second. But first of all, you should always go to every party that you're invited to, if you can, and we'll get to the dangers of not going at the end of the episode. But sometimes you want to get into a party and you're not actually invited. So what do you do then, Peter?
Oh man, there is a book for that. The Book of Party Crashing. Written in 11th century Baghdad, and it is this kind of pretty funny collection of like anecdotes related to party crashing and who was a great party crasher and how to get in. And oh man, it's just a joy to read.
It sounds from this book like there's usually a bouncer on the door of the parties and you got to get past him.
Yeah.
So what are some of the ways that people got into these parties, Peter?
Oh, like one of the usual ones seems to be like pretend you're a cook. Or you pretend you're bringing in food, right? There's some advice that, you know, how to make sure you know all the other servants and what they're doing and things like that, and just kind of get through. Of course, there was like one guy who says, how did you get in? Well, I kept on wailing on the door until they let me in.
Yeah, I like the ones where the people kind of slip in with a group of other people so that everyone thinks that that person knows the host, or the host thinks that that person's with the people who've just come in the door. They just brazen it out walking through the front door.
Yeah. It seems like guys have like no idea who anybody else is in that party, right? And you're just kind of, once you're there, you kind of like, you're on the down low a bit. You know, try not to get into conversation. Don't ask about the host's health. That's like one of the advice, right? Get there and start eating.
Yeah, start eating as fast as you can and stuff your pockets so you can bring stuff home. That's one of the big criticisms in that book of party crashes, is the people that bring the food home. They don't just eat it there. And it's funny because that is definitely a no-no when you're at a party these days. You're not supposed to stuff your pockets and bring that stuff home for later.
You get caught, you can sometimes get away with wordplay and stuff like that and make it a little bit, just being clever can, you know, keep you in, right? There's one guy is like, who are you? And the party crasher says, I'm the one who saved you the trouble of sending an invitation.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites.
Those are all kind of little ways to get through. And it's pretty funny, though. It seems to be like an art. There's a guy named Bunan who's this great party crasher, this infamous party crasher, right? And he's often kind of presented as poor people or like a little bit of a scoundrel that are, you know, getting past the rich, you know? So like there's a bit of that kind of class element there, you know? And there's Arabic literature is always filled with those kind of rogues using their wits to get past the upper echelons of society and, you know, pull one over on everybody.
And the other people that sneak in are the artists and the starving musicians.
It's always about like, you know, what food they can get, like what makes a good meal. Like someone asked Bunan, like, what's the finest food? And he says, the one that makes the owner feel the most generous, which is so true.
Yeah, Peter, this is a book that you're taking a lot of advice from, it sounds like.
Oh, my.
About the food that you like. You like food. It's a good thing.
Oh, okay. All right. Sure.
Yeah, I remember reading in that book, they're mentioning the parties that you shouldn't go to, and the parties you shouldn't go to are ones with like donkey sellers, because all they'll talk about is selling donkeys. You want to go to the parties that are thrown by cloth merchants and the people who are at the top, because those have the best conversation.
Oh, yeah. Avoid the boorish people. But yeah, like don't you imagine you're in Baghdad, 10th or 11th century Baghdad, and you have all these evening parties going on. And yeah, I could just see like, you know, let's go there and chat and while away the summer nights, right?
Follow the right people and you'll always get to the right parties. Okay, so you get into the party, you're in there. I thought something that would be fun to mention would be some of the table manners that people wrote down in the Middle Ages about things that you should definitely not do at the table. Because whenever you see the Middle Ages in movies, there's people that are eating in a really gross way, usually turkey legs, they're wiping their faces on their sleeves, and they're being really gross. So here are some of the things that you should not do if you're at a medieval party. One of the things that I actually saw, I think it was in the movie The King, the one about Henry V, they had Edward II and he was eating off the tip of his eating knife, which is a definite no-no. You're not supposed to do that. That's gross. You're supposed to use your eating knife to carve the food. And if you're carving food for someone, don't eat off your eating knife. It's gross. Imagine the prince doing that.
Well, it was Edward II, so.
Yeah, many people's least favorite king, but still. It's unforgivable. You should also not wipe your mouth on the tablecloth. And I think people might not realize that medieval banquets tended to have tablecloths, and it's gross to lift up the tablecloth and wipe your face on it. So you shouldn't be doing that. You also need to wash your hands, and your host would provide for you a basin to wash your hands in and a towel to clean your hands. So in the Art of Party Crashing, they mention that too. Like, it's the worst behavior to not wash your hands at a meal. Right?
I'm taking notes right now. So,
one other thing you shouldn't do with your eating knife is you shouldn't clean your fingernails with it at the table. Again, just use your knife to carve stuff. Don't clean your fingernails with it. That is pretty gross. And it makes me wonder if they had to write this down, if somebody actually did that and it just horrified everyone else at the table. You also, when you're at a medieval banquet, you're generally sharing a plate or a trencher with the person next to you. So some of the medieval manners have to do with good behavior for treating the person who's your table partner well. And one of the things you're supposed to do is not leave an oil slick on the shared wine cup. So use your napkin. Napkins are provided. They're linen napkins. Wipe your mouth before you take a drink, because otherwise you leave that weird oil slick on the top of the wine and nobody wants to share that.
You know, I don't think I've ever seen a movie about the Middle Ages that featured a napkin.
No.
At a dinner. And so, yeah, we're learning something right now, right?
Well, it makes you think of the fact that you just reposted one of my older articles about medieval stain removal. And imagine trying to get the stains out of these tablecloths and napkins. It's a lot of laundry, but we do have accounts of people doing laundry or renting tablecloths and napkins. Another thing that you shouldn't do is to wipe your fingers on your clothes. That's gross. Use a napkin.
Oh, geez.
I know, back to the napkin.
I know, my girlfriend chides me out about that all the time. So I'm really terrible.
You just outed yourself in front of thousands of people. Okay, it's all right. Peter's girlfriend is reforming him.
Slowly.
Use a napkin, Peter. One other thing you're not supposed to do is to dip your food in the salt. So at a medieval banquet, they usually have a salt cellar on the table. You get your salt from it and you put the salt on your food. But don't dip your food in the communal salt. That's gross. And again, like, I think these are things that people imagine, you know, in the Middle Ages, no one thought of that. They didn't have germ theory. Well, they still knew what stuff was gross. You don't want particles of food in the salt. Yuck. You need to make sure that you give your dining partner the best food. That's very in keeping with the manners that people had at the top of the heap, or I think just human decency, really. You want to give the best food to your dining partner.
It is. It is. Everything when you're kind of dealing with food, there's always symbolism, right? Of like giving the food and stuff like that makes the giver feel better, right?
Yeah, you want to share it, especially if you want to impress the person who's, you know, sharing a trencher with you. They could be really good looking, you know.
Indeed, indeed.
It's just good strategy to be polite. And then finally, you should not eat your trencher. So a trencher is a slab of stale bread, and trencher bread was made specifically for trenchers. Again, this is in the Good Men of Paris. He says, make sure that you order trencher bread, enough for everybody, and then bread for everyone to eat. You're not supposed to eat your trencher. It's your plate and you put all your stuff on it and the sauces will soak into it and stuff like that. But it's uncouth to actually eat your plate.
Really? So, really? I always thought that it was kind of like at the end, they would like, it'd be all so mushy that they'd kind of just dump it into the soup afterwards.
Well, they wouldn't dump it into the soup afterwards. That's gross. You don't want to recycle it. You give it to the poor.
Oh, yeah, afterwards. That's right.
You collect the scraps. And if there's enough scraps and they're good scraps, you could give them to the poor or you give them to the pigs. I mean, I guess if it's extra gross, give it to the pigs instead. But yeah, you give your soggy trencher bread to the poor.
I'm not sure all medieval wealthy people thought the way you did. Give it to the pigs first. And if it's terrible, then you give it to the poor.
Maybe, but I think if people were polite enough to say, don't wipe your fingers on your sleeve, then they were probably thoughtful enough to be charitable, especially because, again, like good manners, that makes you look good being charitable. So even if you're not doing it out of the goodness of your heart, you can do it for your reputation as well.
It was a big thing in the Middle Ages for kings and queens to every once in a while donate huge amounts of food to the poor. One queen gave like 1 million meals to her people in England for the poor. So there was that thing of, you know, like, hey, let's give the poor something, which always meant food, right? Well, rarely money, but
it's probably not the good food. I mean, that good white bread that the people at the upper tables are eating.
Indeed. Yeah.
Probably not that, but maybe the brown bread that the people at the back of the hall are eating. They can have that. Okay, so everyone's eaten very politely. They've washed their hands again because you don't want to be gross. Maybe they've eaten some marzipan castles or some cookies that have a picture pressed into them to tell a story. And now everyone is probably three sheets to the wind on their wine because it's been a really great feast and everyone's leaning back in their chairs. So it's time for some entertainment. What kind of entertainment would you have at a medieval feast or party?
Oh, okay. Well, like there were things like jesters. Jesters, that's really just a kind of a court entertainer, right? And we do have accounts of like royalties, but I always kind of figured everyone has some sort of entertainment lined up. And they'd be to play music, but also like storytelling was really important. I kind of think like, especially in areas like Iceland, where storytelling was like just an art form, right? They just spend hours at it. You'd have that kind of stuff. And then that can become pretty funny stuff, like the fablio, and you could do riddles and jokes. Mm-hmm, really mm-hmm. Great stuff.
Yeah, this is the time when if it's a big party, you can ask someone that you've hired to tell stories to start telling one. If it's a small party, you can ask the person at the party who you know tells the best jokes or the best story. I think we've all been at parties where someone says to someone, tell everyone that story about this. And so I think there's a lot of that too. But you were mentioning jokes and riddles. Do you have some jokes and riddles to share with us from the Middle Ages?
Yeah, I do. There aren't many kind of surviving sources, especially for jokes, but there was an Italian named Poggio Bracchioni. He was like 15th century, and he left this joke book, and there's a whole bunch of kind of funny stuff. I'll just give you one of them that's not too dirty. So
yeah, most of the jokes are either really dirty or really violent. And but
none of them are PC. So well, here we go. The abbot of Septimo, a very corpulent and fat man, was on his way to Florence one evening and inquired of a peasant he met, "Do you think I shall be able to enter the gate?" Of course, he thus meant to ask whether he was likely to reach the city before the closing of the gates. But the country man, thinking about it, replied, "To be sure you will. A cartload of hay can get through. Why shouldn't you?"
Oh, medieval fat shaming. That's not right.
Indeed.
I thought that was going to be a Kingdom of Heaven joke because, I mean, the abbots and bishops and priests are the butt of a lot of jokes. So I thought for sure that was going to be like, you won't get through the gate, pearly gates.
These are all like, yeah, jokes. A lot of them are a bit sexual or kind of potty humor, I guess. So, you know, there's one about a kid like telling you, "Oh, I want everyone to smell my bottom." But they are, you know, pretty funny, I think. And the kind of stuff aimed at skewing the kind of upper classes. So it's always kind of, you know, little bits of, you know, funny little things. And who knows if they're true or not, right? Like some of them, they say they're, you know, hey, this is an actual thing that happened.
The jokes are actual things that happened, I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. Probably not. But that's okay. It's really hard when you come across medieval jokes to find them as hilarious as they must have at the time. Some of them I think are timeless and they're usually the dirty jokes because we can understand those pretty one-to-one. But a lot of the medieval jokes is you're kind of like, what? Is that it? Is that the punchline? I think there's nothing like jokes to show you the difference in culture. If someone has to explain a joke to you, there's more work to be done to understand the culture better. Now, one of the things that people did was also tell riddles. And I know that you love riddles, Peter, don't you?
Yeah, you know, and I find it that like practically every kind of medieval culture has riddles. We know a lot about like the old English ones, but you know, I've kind of searched around and like, yeah, you can find ones from Arabic and Byzantine sources. And there's ones from like the Czech Republic and Italy and Spain. Oh, it's amazing how much it was done. And I guess the idea, like, you know, if you're kind of learned, you would like the kind of wordplay. Some of them are quite tricky, interesting.
Yeah, they're very elaborate. And I suck at them.
Oh, okay. So I'll just give you one of them. I'll give you one. "I have one and you have one. So do the woods, fields, streams, and seas, fish, beasts, and crops, and everything else in this revolving world. What is it?"
I don't know. I don't know. So everything has one. I don't know. See, I would tend to go religious and say a soul, but the sea doesn't have a soul.
Mm.
What is it, Peter?
Well, the answer is a shadow.
Oh.
And I think with the idea of the revolving world, right? The sun going around the earth, I take it. So,
the sun going around the earth. Yep.
That will give you a shadow sooner or later.
Yep. That's true. Now, I have to ask because all the people who like riddles, I will always wonder if they can actually solve them. So, did you solve that one yourself?
Or
did
you
see the answer?
No, I rarely solve them. I can't spend like a minute or two at it. And then like I check the back of the book. I've got these dictionary of riddles books.
I can figure out the ones in The Hobbit, but that's a kid's book.
Indeed. What's in my pocket? You know, it's funny because there's a lot of scholarly literature, like especially about the old English Exeter book riddles, right? Because they don't have answers.
Yeah.
So people have spent, here's what a possible answer for this riddle is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this is like dinner party conversation, right? Like to ask that riddle and then have everyone kind of debate it for hours on end.
Yeah, especially as the party goes on, people are starting to argue about it. I like one of the stories in the Party Crasher book about how time goes on and people drink more. Then they realize one of the people is not supposed to be at the party, but he's such a great guy. They're all quite drunk at that time and they tell him he has to stay on because he's just really great.
Indeed. There are a few other kind of stories like the Macamat where they have the guy kind of, you know, getting there and joining the party and then kind of weaving this tale throughout the night. to keep himself at the party and keep himself the center of the attention. And he, like, and then he kind of like, was I being truthful or was I just lying to get you all to enjoy me for the night?
I think we know the answer to that. But one of the ways that you could stick around if you're a party crasher is if you are a great musician. So one of the ways you could entertain people at a party is to have musicians. So you could hire musicians, of course. There are guilds of musicians that you could hire, and they would come and play at a wedding or something like that for you. If you are a noble, you can hire yourself a troubadour. And I kind of love troubadours because they're on salary. So they can be cheeky because they're getting paid already, but they also will come up with the most flattering bootlicking poetry ever because they're being paid by a patron to speak it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's wonderful. Like, this Lord is the greatest because, and I will spend the next 5-10 minutes just talking about that. And of course, it's all non-specific stuff, right? Like, he's the greatest and most generous and better than the moon and the sun combined.
Yes. So. You'll never find a better Lord. And did I mention that the lady is so beautiful? Everyone wants to be with this lady. I want to be with this lady. It's too bad that I can't be because I'm a humble troubadour. But they do come out with biting stuff. We were talking about, well, I was mentioning it in the podcast on universities. They do have some biting and satirical stuff as well, but it's probably not what you'd bust out at a big celebration or something. That might be as more of an intimate gathering. But some of the instruments that you could pick up and play or carry with you because they're pretty small would be things like a recorder or a flute or a drum or a tambourine.
Yeah, the lute, you know, that was really popular, easy to play, easy to carry around. You see that all the time.
Is it easy to play?
Sure, I picked it up in an hour. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's, I don't know if you want to pick up the lute if you only know a couple of songs. Like, that's like when you're at a campfire and someone has to play Stairway to Heaven. It's the only song they know on the guitar. But yeah, you could play a lute, and that's usually something that a professional would do. There are also really loud instruments you could play, like a shawm, which is a bit like an oboe in structure. It has reeds, but it's really loud, so it's not really an indoor one. Bagpipes as well. You probably don't want to play that inside.
Indeed. Like, you know, it's often said like the horned instruments are more for like military use and stuff like that. So it's all just kind of the stringed instruments are more for the party.
Yeah. And it was good if you were a musician to be able to play some of the soft instruments and some of the louder instruments. In fact, that is advice that was given to minstrels to learn these things so that you could play in a parade. You could play something like a shawm in a parade and you get paid for that. But then you'd want to play something like a recorder in a smaller party gathering so that you're not blasting the ears of all the people that were there.
Exactly.
Not a good idea. Harps as well. When we think about harps, I think that people tend to, I could be wrong, maybe it's just me, but I think that harps are really associated with places like Ireland and Wales, but you could find harps everywhere and they're a nice quiet instrument. You can pick out a melody, you can play chords on it to accompany yourself. So a harp is also very good. A very good option if you are headed to a party.
Yeah, I think that's the intimate flavor of these kind of things. It's background often to the to the kind of conversations and things like that.
Yeah, it's when you think about that, that is one of the biggest differences, I think, between now and medieval parties is these days you can just put on a playlist and it'll just play. But back in the day, you had to have someone actually playing for your entire event if you wanted background music. I mean, you have to pay the players to do that, but also the players have to have enough skill and enough repertoire to do that for you.
And so it's not surprising that if you're royalty in the highest classes in medieval civilization, that you have people just as court entertainers. And that's what they did was follow the court. They were just paid to be there and always there. One of the really interesting things that has come up is that a lot of what we know about early African presence in Europe comes from the fact that these were entertainers in royal courts, often as musicians. And they came into the courts and they get depicted there because, you know, they were new and interesting. Something that was, you know, like, hey, this is something different from the usual. And as a king, I get to show off the best.
Exactly. It's a status symbol to have something that's different and exotic. So if you are in the middle of Europe, then you're going to want to hear a sound from far away and show that off to people to show how sophisticated your tastes are, how cosmopolitan.
Indeed, indeed. To go the opposite way, I'm reading this work about this like 15th century guy in Damascus who did binge reading for his parties.
Binge reading?
Yes, binge reading. He had his extended family, but he would also have like, other people kind of come in, and they would have someone like read and recite books for like hours, and he recorded this. Like, we spent 8 hours reading this book. And here were all the people that were there, right? So, but yeah, it was a binge reading. And we're talking about like they did hundreds of books over a year.
Yeah, well, why not? Right? There's lots of stories in later periods of people who would sit down and say, okay, we're all going to read Shakespeare today, and you're going to be this part. That was like party entertainment. Why not? It's nice to hear people doing the same thing in the Middle Ages, telling stories.
Exactly.
Now, I haven't come across this source. Were they reading this, like actually reading it or reciting it?
In this case, yeah, he had this collection, this library collection. He or his one of his sons or one of his assistants would be the readers, and then you'd have an audience around of men and women, and up to maybe like 20 or 30 people that would kind of listen there and kind of just take it in. And he was a very big note taker, so he explained exactly what was read, who was in attendance. When his sons didn't show up, he would like, my son did not show up for this.
They got grounded, I'm sure.
He did mention like one of my wives had a child this morning, and the boy was in attendance for the reading this afternoon. Aw.
Wow,
Yes.
that's dedication.
We have like a couple years of records from this guy, just talking about the reading parties he did. So binge reading.
I love it. I love it. One of the things I was thinking about when I was thinking about what we could talk about and whether entertainment could be at a party like this is that both you and I are Canadian, and I think in North America we rarely have sing-alongs unless you are actively in front of a campfire.
Okay.
Nobody sings along. I don't know, maybe you do, but I feel like at a party people rarely like start singing. But this is something that people in other cultures do quite a lot.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
Like at the end of the night, everybody has had an enjoyable time, and somebody will start singing, and everyone will join in. But we don't tend to do that in North America, or at least maybe not the circles that I've been in. But that's definitely something people did as well, was they sang together songs that they knew together. So it wasn't just one person performing all the time.
Indeed, indeed. And I would imagine there'd be dancing as well. That's a possibility. And medieval dancing was often group dancing.
Yeah, which I don't think we do enough of these days either. I mean, we're not supposed to be gathering in big groups to dance now, but some of that group dancing is really awesome. It's fun. I don't know if you've done it, Peter, but group dancing, like Kaylee style dancing, is really, really fun.
Well, International Medieval Congress, I've done a couple of dances there
You
where
didn't take a video?
I think we were not allowed to do that. It's like that does not leave the room.
That sounds fair. Yep. That would be and end up on medieval TikTok pretty quickly, I think. All right, so we've gone to the party, we've crashed it, we've eaten, we've had entertainment and stuff like that. It's been a great time. It's probably time to leave. If you are staying at a castle and you don't necessarily have a room to sleep in, you can get a pallet, you can stay in the Great Hall usually. Everyone else who lives close by could stumble home or walk home carefully in the dark, or they could sleep over if they really need to. But it's been a great party. What happens, Peter, if you don't go to a party in the Middle Ages that you are invited to?
Well, there is a story of a guy named Manetto. He was called the woodworker or the fat woodworker. So this is apparently a true story, but it's hard to know if you can believe it or not. But he was part of like a group of friends that would have these dinner parties in Florence in a year 1409. And for some reason, he does not show up to one. And all his friends start talking, and they're a little miffed that he doesn't. So they're trying to figure out how to get revenge on poor Manetto. And the leader of this group is a famous guy, Brunelleschi, the Florentine artist and architect. So, and he comes with the idea, we're going to make him believe that he is not Manetto. We're going to make him believe he's this other guy named Matteo.
Wow.
And it all starts, Brunelleschi locks Mateo out of his home. People on the street, his friends, like, "Hey, Mateo." And like, who are you talking to? Like, he can't get into his house. He's like wandering the street. And then like other people like claim, "Hey, Mateo, you owe me money." And they drag him to jail, for the debtor's prison. He has to spend a night in jail. Of course, nobody in there knows who he is, not even the judge. So like, he's like, "I'm Mineto. Ah, we don't know who you are." So he's starting to go crazy, and it just gets worse. They put him through hell for a couple of days. They go into his woodworking shop and move everything around so that someone else has been working. And they talk about, "Oh, I already saw Mineto. He's in the work." Poor guy. So it's a great story. I've been reading it, and I'm going to post about it soon. But I feel that was a good revenge story. So if you do not show up, that could be trouble.
That's a good revenge story? That's terrible. Poor guy. All for missing a dinner party.
Yeah, like, jeez. No mercy on him. But like, after a few days, his mom, he finds his mom, and then, yeah, I really am Mineto, but he goes through a lot. You imagine the planning, because all like, you know, like 30 or 40 people must have planned this out, doing their various roles.
Wow, that's commitment.
So you can see what you can do in a party. Like, it's, you know, all right, let's plot someone's horrible demise.
It's like, you don't want to be the first person to fall asleep at a sleepover, I guess.
Indeed, I've had that trouble before.
This is Peter with a lot of confessions today. So there you go. If you get in a time machine, you go back to the Middle Ages and you get invited to a party, you should definitely go. And if you don't get invited to a party, you should still go anyway. Yes. Because there's going to be good food. And now you know how to sneak in past the bouncer.
That's right. Yeah, so go to a party, whether or not you're invited.
And that's the moral of the story. We are educating people out here. All right, Peter, what's new on the website this week?
Hey, we got a piece about the top 10 cities in the medieval world. When I say we, that's the royal we. But
all right.
The idea was just that what were like the cities that were kind of the most important economically, politically, over that kind of millennia period. And so I have places from Asia, Europe, Africa, that all kind of make that list. And I put Constantinople as the number one city. That is the typical medieval city.
I'm shocked by that, Peter. Shocked Indeed. By that.
So there are some cities that you will know and other cities that you might not know very well, like that are a little less known today. So we've got that. And also the second episode of Bow and Blade is now out. So.
Oh, excellent. That's great.
It's on the Battle of Brunanburh.
Yes. Those two have done a lot of work on that. That's Michael Livingston and Kelly DeFries. And while we're talking about podcasts, it's worth mentioning that your favorite city, Constantinople, has its own podcast too, with Byzantium and Friends, with Anthony Caldelis.
Oh, yes. He's on a bit of hiatus, but we're kind of catching up with older episodes that we're kind of putting online. So yeah, I'm waiting for him to come back because, yeah, he's a wonderful talker and they have great guests.
Yeah, I agree. I definitely agree. All right. Well, thanks, Peter, for coming on, telling us about parties and what's on the website.
Hey, thanks.
If you'd like to read The Art of Party Crashing in Medieval Iraq for yourself, you can find it in translation by Emily Seelove. Thank you, as always, to our patrons on patreon.com for all your support. Patrons of the Medieval Podcast can choose from all sorts of amazing things like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, membership in our book club, and our exclusive maps by Tina Ross. To find out how to become a patron of the Medieval Podcast, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from parties to patrimonies, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter @medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Cebulski, on social media at 5minmedievalist or 5minutemedievalist. And you can find my books at all your favorite online bookstores, where you can even pre-order the new one, How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, which comes out next month. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an amazing day.